Thank you very much. Well, I first would like to thank the organizers for giving me this opportunity to give this talk. I noticed interestingly that the previous speaker had the scrolling. Where is Peter? It's yours. Can I use it? Thank you very much. Does it scroll?
No, it doesn't scroll.
Ah, no, I have a laser pointer.
Okay.
I thought you were scrolling. Thank you. Okay, sorry. Sorry, so this I have. Okay. So, this is a joint work with my almost former student, Arash Fahim, who is here within this program, who is sitting somewhere, and with Xavier Barin, who works at the electricity company in France, and who was interested in this type of methods for Bellman equations. Okay, so I will start by giving the motivations which came from American options. We saw some talks on this, so I will go very quickly on this. And then I will describe the scheme. Then I will be describing the scheme, and I will give you some numerical results at the end. Okay, so American options. This everybody knows this story, in this room at least. So we are given some process which models the payoff if you exercise at each time t. So gt is how much you get if you decide to exercise at time t. And then it is well known that if you are in complete market, usual theory, probability measure here is the richness of probability measure, so we're not entering this kind of debate, then you are reduced to an optimal stopping problem, as Chris was explaining yesterday. You have to maximize expected value of g of tau over all stopping rules, tau, before capital T. And also, it is well known and very used, widely used in the finance literature and also in the industry, that this problem can be solved by over a discrete time mesh, TK, and by approximating the so-called Snell envelope, which is a version of dynamic programming for this optimal stopping problem. So you have to go backward in time, and you start from the final payoff, and you maximize, you take the maximum between immediate exercise or holding the option up to the next period. This is one of the first things that you learn in finance. Usually you learn on the binomial tree, but there are many extensions and many methods to do this. So this is a very standard numerical scheme, in particular in the industry. And the only numerical complexity in applying this scheme is, of course, in the blue guy here, how to compute this condition expectation. This is a non-trivial problem. And I will wrap up this problem just in one slide, because I'm not going to talk about it anymore. So there are many methods. I have collected in this slide a collection of these methods, and I apologize if I don't cite any other methods. So basically, the main observation here is that typically we work with Markov models, Markovian models, so these condition expectations are not too wide in the sense that these are just regressions. These are, you have to take a projection on XTI, the current value of the underlying process, which makes it easier to do. Otherwise, it's really complicated. So typically in this case, you need to compute this type of condition expectations, and here we are in business because this is a well-documented problem in statistics. So there are classical methods from statistics, like the kernel projection, which was suggested by Carrière in the finance literature. There are methods which are related to projection on subspaces, which was popularized in finance by Longstaff and Schwarz. And I will be showing an example with this method, Gobelo-Mawaha, who typically use this method, but in a non-parametric way, in the sense that these are like basis projection, and the basis adapts to the part of the space where you are. Many of these methods fall into the stochastic mesh method, which was suggested by Brody and Glasserman. And you have other types of methods like quantization. And we also suggested some methods based on integration by part. So there are many methods. You choose your favorite methods, and you replace E by E hat by this approximation. And we're going to forget about this in the future. Okay. So the objective of my talk is to show you that from this very simple idea, which is very well known in finance in the context of American options, in fact, we can solve a wide range of problems. Namely, we can solve nonlinear PDEs. Nonlinear PDEs appears in many applications, but in particular in finance. So here are some problems of interest. Of course, continuous time portfolio optimization. I would give an example. My numerical example would be within this type of problems. But we have seen, in particular in this conference, people talking about algorithmic trading under market impact. And usually we want to formulate this as stochastic control problems. So usually we end up with Bellman equations, which are nonlinear PDEs. And also there are equations coming from hedging in illiquid markets, et cetera, et cetera. So these are just some examples. But my objective is to show that once you know how to use this approximation of condition expectation E by some E hat, by your favorite method, then you can extend this type of method to more complicated problems, fully nonlinear PDEs. Okay. So now let me introduce the scheme. If there is a time where you have to look at my slides, is now, and then you can sleep, because then I will talk about how can we ensure convergence, etc. So the main idea is coming in the two or three slides which are coming. Then you can, you can sleep or check your emails or whatever. Okay, so the main idea is here. So we are given this nonlinear PDE. So I'm just, because I have a space constraint, I'm writing curly D for V, DV, D2V. And capital D stands here for the space derivative. This is derivative with respect to variable X, and I'm denoting VT for the derivative with respect to T. Okay? So I am given this fully nonlinear equation, very general for the moment. We will see what kind of restrictions we are going to put. Very general, but it already excludes the equation that we have seen in the previous talk, for example. I don't allow here for variation inequalities. And it's going to be important. I'm not saying that what we are doing does do not apply to that, but for the moment what we are doing, we only prove theorems for in this context. So no variation inequalities. Well, obstacle problem, we can do it, because American option for PDE is an obstacle problem. But it's already complicated like that, so we start with this context. So I'm excluding any variation inequality type of problems. So I just take fully nonlinear PDEs with this nonlinear operator S, which applies to T, X, or V, DV, D2V. Okay, so what I'm going to do with this, from this capital S, I'm going to isolate a Laplacian term. And, well, basically, what I would like to do here, I can isolate any linear term in the gradient and linear term in the Hessian, because that would be the generator of some diffusion. I just want to isolate the generator of some diffusion. Well, here for simplicity, I take 1, because 1 corresponds to the Brownian motion. And then I can do all my story with Brownian motion. Okay? And obviously here, you have lots of choices, because the difference between capital F and little f is what you put here. So you have lots of choices. You can put any gradient, linear gradient term. You can put any diffusion term linear in the second derivative, and then you can do the same thing. So here we have a lot of degrees of freedom. So if I choose this with this choice of diffusion 1, I am having in mind the underlying process which is given here, which is just the Brownian motion, that I'm starting on some initial data, little x. If I choose another diffusion here, it would be reflected there. So this is why I'm calling this component of the scheme the Monte Carlo component, in the sense that when I'm doing this choice, when I'm making this choice, I'm deciding that I want to look at this equation through this process. So I'm deciding I want, this is going to be like a skeleton for me, and I'm going to look at my equation through this process. Okay, then what you can do once you isolate this diffusion, you evaluate this equation along the path of this process, SXS. I evaluate everything along SXS, still equal to 0, of course. Integrate between T minus h and t still equal to 0. Then you realize that you are missing just the diffusion term, the dv times dw. If you had that diffusion term, then you would have an Itô's formula here. Okay? To do that, you can still take expected values. You take expected values, this is still equal to 0. Okay? So up to here, we're just starting from here, evaluate it along the process, integrate between t minus h and t, take expected value, everything equal to 0. But once you take expected value, you can add the diffusion term, the stochastic integral term. Okay, we're not going to bother ourselves with local multicase. Maybe Philip Proter is going to talk about that in the next talk. But in here, expected value of the integral of the integral dw, let's forget about it, that's equal to 0. And if you accept that, then Itô's formula tells you that this integral part of this part is just vt minus h minus vt of xt. Okay? So that's just Itô's formula. And the way I want to use this is to say, okay, this formula allows me to get v at time t minus h out of the function v at time t. This is my backward recursion. This is going to be my backward recursion. Except that I still have this integral here. But this integral is not very wild because this is just a Riemann integral. Okay? So, from the previous slide, I just approximate the Riemann integral by the value of the nonlinearity times the time step. And since this is a Riemann integral, I can evaluate anything inside at any point in between t minus h and t. It doesn't matter. There's no dw there. Okay? It doesn't matter. Now here, I am going to make a particular choice. I'm going to do two things. First, in the previous slide, the expected value was outside the integral. F is nonlinear. I'm going to take the expected value inside the F. Well, of course, if F is convex or concave, there will be a Jensen inequality. If F is neither convex neither concave, which I'm not assuming here, it can happen anything. But remember, what I'm interested in is to send H to 0. So at the end, this is reasonable to do. When H goes to 0, it wouldn't make any difference. This is what we hope, at least. So I take the expected value inside, and then I evaluate F at expected value dv hat of t xt. Remember, this is conditional expectation t minus h. There's a t minus h there. Okay? Now, why is this interesting? Well, when you see this, typically you panic because you say, well, this is not going to work, because in order to determine v at time t minus h out of v at time t, not only you need v hat at time t, but only you need the gradient of v hat, the Hessian of v hat, so this is a non-ending process. How am I going to do? But because I have put the expected value inside, I can use a trick, which is the integration by parts. Because this expected value, I'm writing the formulas in dimension 1 now, but obviously you have similar formulas in higher dimension. This expected value, this is well known in the Greeks. This you integrate by parts and you write it as v of t and xt, v hat should be v hat, I'm sorry, v hat of t and xt times some weight, d2 v hat times some weight. In the next slide, I will recall very quickly, very briefly, for those who are not familiar with this, how to get this formula. From this formula, you just replace in there, and you get this backward recursion, which tells you how to get v hat at t minus h out of v hat at time t, and observe that in here, I only use the value function v and not its gradient or its Hessian. So now it starts becoming doable, and we start believing this is something that we can implement. But of course, you have to do exactly as in American options. You have to replace E by E hat by an approximation of the condition expectation. But that's in principle we know how to do from American options.
Yeah. Sure.
Here,
I mean, switch from differentiating
with respect to
xt versus xt minus h in the
integration of all differentiations here are with respect to the initial condition. Okay, so. You're right. This differentiation here is with respect to this guy.
Yeah.
Okay?
Right,
H is small. Okay, in the limit we hope that things are going to work out, okay? But we have to prove it. Okay, so this is just to recall for those who are not familiar with this integration by parts. If you have this expected value of f prime, so we are just interested in the derivative with respect to the space variable, then for the Brownian motion, you know exactly what is the density of the Brownian motion. You just integrate by parts, so you get f, and then when you differentiate this guy, you get a weight y over h, which you can represent in terms of expected value, and you get the w h divided by h. And exactly as you've done it for the f prime, you can do it for the f double prime, and then you have to integrate twice. So you have to do this one more time. So you have to differentiate y over h, expected value of minus y squared, blah, blah, blah. You have y, which appears both here and here, so you get these two terms. And, well, basically you get the Hermite polynomials. This is exactly how you get the Hermite polynomials. And for the f double prime, the approximation is given by this weight. And the interest of this is that the weight does not depend on the function f. So we can really make use of it in the scheme. Okay, so in this slide, I'm just rewriting differently this ugly equation. So to rewrite it differently, I'm going to give a name to this guy, a name to this one, and a name to this one. I'm going to call this y, this is z, and this is gamma. Gamma, of course, comes from finance. That second derivative of Black-Scholes, that's gamma. So, in summary, this is what we are suggesting. You start from the final data, ytn equals g of xtn, and then you go backward in time, yti minus 1 as a function of yti. This is my v. This is the value function. This is the gradient term. This is the Hessian term. And with this integration by part, we are computing the gradient term by this conditional expectation of the value function times the weight. Expected value, value function times the weight for the second derivative, and you get that. So this is what we are suggesting. And again, if you think about the numerical complexity, we have exactly the same difficulty as for American options, because the only thing that we need to compute and to approximate sharply is this conditional expectation. So if we know how to do it for American options, we are in business for this problem. Okay. Let me say a little bit more words, because in here in the titles of my slide, I had first the Monte Carlo component, which was my choice of the underlying process. That's my first degree of freedom. And then I talk about the finite differences component. Let me justify this name, because I want to interpret this algorithm as a mix of Monte Carlo and finite differences. Okay, let's go back to this formula, this integration by part formula. So this is what we have done. If you integrate by part, p prime of xh is expected value of p of xh times the weight. Now think of the approximation of the Brownian motion by a binomial tree. Okay? If you approximate the Brownian motion by the binomial tree, so this is plus or minus root of h with probability 1/2 in order to match the first moment of the Brownian motion, 0, and the second moment, which is h. So if you think about this approximation, then this expected value is approximately p at x plus root of h, this is a plus 1 move, the minus comes from the minus 1, minus root h move. This is minus p of x minus root h, and there's the 1/2 of the probability, and this is the 2 root h. So 1 h is coming from here, and the root h is coming from here. Okay? So in fact, this integration by part formula is, at least for the first order, is nothing but the Monte Carlo way of computing the centered finite difference. We are going to work with Monte Carlo. When you work with grids in finite differences, you know exactly how to approximate the gradient, the Hessian. If you work with Monte Carlo, then the path goes everywhere, and you don't understand exactly how to do the finite difference. Integration by part tells you exactly what you have to do. So this is saying that the integration by part formula that we have, this is telling us how to compute the finite difference in our context of Monte Carlo paths. You can have a similar observation for the second one with the weight w h squared minus h divided by h squared, but for here you have to work a little bit more, Because, of course, if you want to approximate the second derivative, then basically you have to do a Taylor expansion of this psi of xh up to the order 2. And in order to be exact, then you have to conserve the moments up to the moment number 4 of the Brownian motion. Otherwise, you're going to miss the second derivative. And if you want to be good on the first 4 moments, then you have to go away from the binomial tree, and you have to add one more branch in your tree. And basically, this is the only choice. If you have 3 branches, the only way to have to have the same first, second, third, and fourth moment of the Brownian motion is to have exactly this way, this weight. And then if you accept this approximation, then this suggests exactly the centered second finite difference approximation. So the integration by part is doing the same thing as Fredrik Bergens. So really, this integration by part is working exactly like finite differences. Yeah? So this scheme, what this scheme is really doing is Monte Carlo step, you choose the underlying process, and the finite difference step, once you choose the underlying process, you are left with nonlinearity F, and in the nonlinearity F, just do finite differences. The Monte Carlo way of doing finite differences. Okay? Okay, so let's see. Let me concentrate a little bit on the semi-linear case. In the semi-linear case, my nonlinearity F does not depend anymore on the Hessian component. So my equation is linear in the second derivative component. I put everything in the underlying process, and I get an F which does not contain any underlying process. And the question that I want to ask is, suppose I'm doing this Monte Carlo type of probabilistic scheme, so I have a bunch of paths. This is my final time. I start from G at the final time, and I go backward in time. And at every time ti, I would compute my value function at each node by using the value function at the next node. Okay? If you do this, then you are creating numbers everywhere on your Monte Carlo path. So the natural question is, what are we constructing? What kind of object are we constructing by doing this? Well, in the semi-linear case, the answer is well known, and maybe I should skip some pages here. The answer is well known, and it is related to backward SDEs. In fact, what we are creating is a solution of backward SDE. I'm recalling here very quickly what is a backward SDE. For those who are not familiar with this notion, we want to solve a stochastic differential equation, but with a final condition, capital G, which is in here my final for my PDE, G of X capital T. So I start from G of X capital T, and I want to go backward, and I want to create an adapted solution. That's backward SDE. So there's a theory for that, and basically what we can prove is that this scheme, I want to skip this one as well. If you do this scheme, this is exactly the scheme that I was showing before, which appeared in the backward SDE literature under this form exactly, then there are some convergence results. We know that if you don't replace the expected value by e hat, so this is the discretization, which is not implementable. If you take the discretization, then you have a convergence with the root n rate as usual, exactly as in for forward SDEs. So you have a convergence of the one y component and of the z component. And also, in the linear case, we know that we can do better because this is a weak problem. In the linear case, we are approximating an expected value, so we expect the rate to be of order 1 over n, and it is also true in this case, although there are these intermediate steps. So this is a paper by Gobert and Labat, which shows that, but in here, the difference is that I'm looking only at the value at time 0. If you look only at the value at time 0, then you have this rate 1 over n. Whereas in here, I'm looking at all the trajectory. So by doing this, we are creating this backward SDE, in fact. Okay, there are also, if you replace E by E hat now, the Monte Carlo error comes into play, and there are bounds on the rate of convergence. We don't know that the, whether these are the optimal bounds. They are not, I'm sure. And then basically how to read all these numbers, basically what these numbers say is that if you want to have to still keep the 1 over root n order of convergence, then this is how much sample path you have to simulate. Capital N of the order of n cubed plus d over 2, which is somehow disappointing, because when we start doing Monte Carlo, we love Monte Carlo, we like very much Monte Carlo, because we feel the rate of convergence does not depend on the dimension. So in here, the rate of convergence comes into play, because we are doing these successive regressions. So, but it's not so wide, because it's a power type of dependence. Okay, so this is the story for the semi-linear case. Now, in the fully nonlinear case, remember, now I have this gamma, again, gamma like in finance, second derivative, I have this gamma component, and gamma is determined by regressing the next step value function on the second Hermite polynomial. So you compute gamma from here, you compute z from here, you plug in there, and you do a fixed point for yti minus 1, which is not very complicated because you have a delta t here, so this is very contracting. Otherwise, you can make it explicit. It doesn't change even the rate of convergence. Okay, now things get more difficult, basically because if you look at what happens if you add this component, with this component, think of the Brownian motion to be of the order of root delta t. So in here, you would have a term of the order of 1 over root delta t, which gets multiplied by delta t, sure, but still creates O1 term. Whereas for the dependence on z, it was somehow easier because we still have 1 over root delta t here. Okay? So this term is really creating trouble for us, and because of this, we were not able so far to generalize the previous results, but we hope that our recent progress on second order BSDs will help us to handle this. So because of that, I will just show you convergence results of this scheme only for the value at the node. I will not be talking about the whole process as for standard BSDs. This is all we have for the moment. And the results that we have is the following. So let me start reading from the end of the slide, because we had this nice talk before. To prove convergence, we use this method of stability, consistency, and monotonicity, although we have a stochastic scheme. So we can show that these methods still work, even in this case. And the bounds are obtained by the methods, very beautiful methods, very tricky methods of Krylov and Bahr-Jacobsen, which allow to have bounds on the approximation error, but don't work for obstacle problems, for example. Only work for in my context. And in the context where the nonlinearity is convex now, to have the bounds of convergence. Whereas convergence is obtained without assuming any convexity. So, because the essence of this method, of course, relies on comparison theorem, as it was outlined by Peter before, and I am assuming for this convergence that the PDE, the nonlinear PDE that we are working on, satisfies a comparison result for bounded supersolutions and subsolutions in the sense of viscosity solutions, which means that if I have a supersolution of the equation, a subsolution of the equation, which can compare on the boundary, supersolution greater than the subsolution on the boundary, then they have to compare all over the space. And that implies uniqueness. So this is a standing assumption, because this is inherent to the method of that we use to prove convergence. So there is convergence, again, for the value at the node. So Tx, there is no processes here, no processes. And we have bounds on the rate of convergence, which are given by these bounds. And, well, this is also related to this method. I don't want to elaborate on that. I just want to catch your attention on this condition. This is a sufficient condition for our result. And as a sufficient condition, we assume that, so So remember, in the beginning, we had this nonlinear PDE. I started from the PDE minus VT minus, I started from capital F of V dV d2V equals 0. And then I insisted on the fact that I can create any diffusion here. Any gradient term, linear Hessian term that I can interpret as a generator of a diffusion. So let's take this diffusion minus 1/2 of sigma squared now. Vxx, d2V. Let me write dimension 1, right? And then I call the rest F. So the difference between little f and capital F is just this Laplacian term. Okay? We have a lot of degrees of freedom, but we have a sufficient condition in this theorem which says that the diffusion must dominate the nonlinearity, the dependence of the nonlinearity in terms of gamma. It's not a necessary condition. We can only prove our result under this condition. The diffusion must dominate the nonlinearity, which looks to be natural when you think about it. You don't want this guy to take over. You want to create some diffusion. Remember, we are doing regression, so you need some randomness. And also, I will show you the numerical result. You will see that if you take small diffusions, then it doesn't work. The algorithm looks to do very badly. Okay, so I'll go back to this point later. So again, that's the convergence result, rate of convergence, but only at the node of the tree. We know for the moment the problem of looking at all the processes is still open. Okay. Now the next result is what happens if I replace the conditional expectation by the approximation of conditional expectation. Take your favorite method, long stuff farce or whatever. You replace E by E hat. What happens to the previous theorem? And then, of course, if I'm here, is to tell you that it works. And as usual, it works. You have to put the right things so that it works. And this tells you somehow, if you have any method, so this is, take your favorite method and do some analysis to see how the error is behaving with this method. Then I'm creating this dependence on H, and dependence on H is a time step. Capital N is the number of sample paths. And these are two parameters, lambda and nu, which depend on the method that you are going to use. Okay, so with this parameter, this will tell you how much sample paths you have to choose so that you can guarantee convergence with 1 over root n rate of convergence, because you like that. So again, you can prove convergence at the node towards the unique solution of the PDE, and you can have bounds on the rate of convergence, and this should be v hat. Because this inequalities, we have seen them in the previous slide. This should be V hat. Okay. Let's go to some numerical results. Let's see how it works. Does it really work? Can we do? Well, our objective, of course, is to do high dimensional problems. So, how far can we go in the dimension? Is it possible? Is it implementable? Is it reasonable to do it? Okay. So I'm recalling this. Degrees of freedom. So if you have BSDE is a semi-linear case. In the semi-linear case, there is no dependence in the nonlinearity on D2V. Everything is linear in D2V, and typically we know very well that we can split a gradient term, linear gradient term, in between the operator and the nonlinear function F. That's just changing the drift, in fact. If you think about Feynman-Kac representation, this is changing the drift, so it's changing the measure, and this is the well-known important sampling in Monte Carlo, which is well-studied, well-understood in the linear, for linear PDEs, because linear PDEs, you end up with expected values, and we know what is the optimal important sampling, well, which is not feasible, so you have to approximate, etc. We know exactly what's the story about that. So there is a similar feature in the semilinear case, but to my knowledge, this is an open question to understand what is the optimal drift to add to the equation basically it's difficult even to formulate the problem because you have regressions at every node of the Monte Carlo tree. So you have to have something which incorporates the whole Monte Carlo scheme. So that's open. And what is added with this new context is not only we can choose mu, but now we can also choose sigma. And that's mysterious. And I don't think this has been done before. Basically, if you change sigma, then the underlying processes generate singular measures, so we don't understand what is going on there. But the scheme says this. This scheme says you can choose this sigma. Okay, let's see what is the effect of that. So, first results, dimension one. I will give more dimension later on, but this is just to start to understand this drift and volatility. So I'm taking this very simple optimal portfolio investment problem with these weird notations. So I'm denoting by Y the value of the wealth because I want to be consistent with my previous notations. So Y is the value of the wealth and Z is the portfolio. Very weird notations. So you have to switch from X theta to YZ. So, and this is just Black-Scholes model, and you take exponential utility function, maximize expected value of expected utility. Of course, everybody knows that in this context, there's an explicit solution. And then we can compare our scheme to this explicit solution. And the PDE for this is given by this nonlinearity, which is very, very weird, which doesn't satisfy my assumptions because I'm assuming typically that F has to be Lipschitz, etc. But remember, in the Merton, in this particular problem, the optimal portfolio is constant. So you can replace this PDE by cutting at infinity. You can replace by any Lipschitz PDE as long as the domain contains the optimal solution. So it's fakely wild. It's a nice problem. It's a nice PDE, in fact. Okay, so I'm in this table. This row gives you the relative error compared to the explicit solution. And in this row, I'm changing the drift, important sampling. Important sampling, but this is not linear problem. So I'm changing the drift. The drift is going to from minus 1 to 0.8. And you see this is the relative error. Well, what you see is that, it is doing well in terms of relative error. The error is very small. And by moving the drift, it looks like, the error is decreasing up to some point, and then it starts increasing. So it looks like there is a sign of some optimal choice, but we know that there is one in the linear case. So this is just to understand if it is going to be important here, but it's not so important. If you look at the numbers, these are all small numbers. The effect of the volatility now. Now, if you change the scale, I'm changing the sigma. Remember, my theorem says that if I want to ensure convergence, sufficient condition is that the diffusion must beat the nonlinearity in terms of dependence on the gamma component, on the second derivative component. And here I'm changing the diffusion from 0.2 to 1.6. So you see that if the diffusion is very small, I am violating the assumption of my theorem, probably. And in that case, I have 50% of error, even 60%. This is really pushing very, very high in terms of number of trajectories, etc. And there are two rows here because we wanted to understand whether this error is inherent to some method of E hat, replacing E by E hat. So in this row, E is replaced by E hat by projection on basis, long stuff sparse, but with basis adapted to the space. That's the Gobet-Lemoine-Varin method. And in this row, we are doing the quantization methods of Paget, etc. So you see that with both methods, we are doing very, very bad. So it confirms that this type of assumption is somehow sharp in some sense. Okay. Now, increase the volatility. We're doing bad with this method, less bad with this one. And then suddenly, for some volatility, you're in business. We're getting good relative errors. Good relative errors. And then at 1.4, this is a big volatility. Bigger volatility, it start increasing. So there seems that there is something there, but again, I have no mathematics about that. I cannot say anything more, any formal definition of optimality, of optimal drift or optimal diffusion. Now let's go to higher dimension examples. In here, I'm taking an optimal investment problem, same problem, exponential utility function, maximizing expected exponential utility of terminal wealth, but I'm playing with the underlying. And in here, I'm still taking zero interest rate, and I'm taking one stock with stochastic volatility. If you write the PDE for this, you get exactly this. This is just the Bellman equation, nonlinear, widely nonlinear. So we just cut off this quadratic thing to have some ellipses from the numerical point of view. And, well, we know for this particular problem, and this is the reason why we have chosen this particular problem, we know that because of the exponential, we can get rid of the dependence on x, because we know that the solution should be of the type exponential minus eta x times the function of y. So this was used in the paper by Stalia, by Popolu. And also, we know that once you take away the dependence on x, if you do a power transformation, then you get a linear PDE. And this is the reason, this is how Thalia obtains this quasi-explicit solution, in the sense that this is an L1 minus rho square norm. This is an expected value, in fact. So we're back to classical Monte Carlo, linear Monte Carlo. So I believe that linear Monte Carlo is undiscussable, so I'm going to take just a crude Monte Carlo to compute this value, and I consider it as the true value. So I'm going to compare my numerical result to this quasi-explicit solution. Okay, so let's look at the results. No, the results are not here. The results are, unfortunately, I didn't upload. The results are here. I can make them bigger. Oops. Okay, these are the results, and we are applying two types of methods. I don't have time to talk about the two types of methods. On the x-axis, there is a time step. So when the time step goes to zero, we expect to have convergence. This is the relative error, again. And, well, what we see is that with this method, there are some weird things happening, in the sense that when time step goes to zero, these are different volatilities. The bigger volatility is the purple one. The smallest volatility is the red curve, and then green and blue. So with the red curve, you see that the error increases when the time step goes to zero. So it's behaving very bad. So again, this is the problem of diffusion dominated by the nonlinearity. And with the others, it looks like it's doing well, but for small time space, it doesn't work very well. So with the other method, so this is now done with projection, basis projection. Well, basically, except the red guy, which was the small diffusion, smallest diffusion, all other diffusions exhibit decrease. So it looks like it's converging, and it is converging because now we are comparing to the explicit solution. Okay, so it is working. And to give you an idea, one calculation is about 100, so it's 1 minute and a half. One calculation is about 1 minute and a half. So this is two dimension in space and one time dimension. Okay, let me go back to my final numerical example. Sure. No, there is no perturbation. My stochastic volatility model is fixed, but I'm applying my scheme with some time step. This is my parameter H. And I am drawing the relative error to the explicit solution, quasi-explicit solution, as a function of the time step. So I expect that to be decreasing, like for the purple curve, the blue curve, and the green curve. For the red curve, it behaves badly. And this is a case where the volatility is very small. Okay? Right. Right. It's again, stochastic volatility gives me this. Everything is a nonlinearity, and then I decide, I choose some volatility for my simulation, and I keep everything in the vector F. Good question, I don't know. We have not been to that level of details for the simulation, but that's a good question. We may ask if you have a sensible choice of this volatility, of course. Okay, one final example. Final example is five dimension. This is how far we could go. We didn't try later, but with five dimension, in this example, one calculation is about 1 hour. So it's still doable. I think with finite differences, I'm not sure you can handle this type of nonlinearities. It's still doable, but it's 1 hour, so we stop there. But maybe someone more expert in numerics and in calculations, in computation, and maybe with parallelization type of methods, we can reduce down this time step, this time of computation. So here for this example, I am taking stochastic volatility with an Ornstein automatic process. I'm taking two stocks, and both have stochastic volatility. One of them is just Heston model, and the other is CEV. So when you write things, then you see that I didn't write everything here, because you can imagine the AGB equation. We have five dimensions. So we have an AGB equation with five states plus time. And for simplicity, in this example, we assume all Brownian motion are independent. But again, we are not using any trick to take advantage of this independence. We're just doing Monte Carlo. So, now we don't have a benchmark to see what is the true value to compare to, but it looks to work well. Let me just find it in the paper. Okay, so this is again with the method which work well, which is again the Longstaff and Schwarz type of methods. So you see a decrease of the error as the time step goes to zero, and here red is not the red before. We are not doing this very small volatility case. So in all cases, it looks to be decreasing and to be converging to the to some good solution, but we don't know what is the explicit solution again. Okay, so this is my time to stop, and thank you very much for your attention.